in which the question of the day is, what is President Trump actually trying to do on trade anyway? Not a trick question, by the by. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, May the 20th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We lead the program today with a story from the Global Economy Comes at You Fast, You Gotta Keep Up file. The Ford Motor Company announced this morning it's cutting 7,000 salary jobs worldwide, about 10% of its white-collar employees. It's all part of a big multi-year restructuring program that CEO Jim Hackett has embarked upon. You might remember, though, that Ford made it through the financial crisis without the bankruptcy filings that GM and Chrysler had to make. And the F-150 pickup truck has been a bestseller and huge profit maker for decades now. But as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, Ford, along with all the other car companies, is gearing up for a more challenging future.
The auto industry is anticipating some major technological disruption to its business. But as part of planning for that, Michelle Krebs at Auto Trader says companies have to keep doing what they're doing.
Automakers absolutely cannot take their eye off the ball of today's business, because that is what is creating the funding to finance this future that we don't know when it's going to happen.
That future for Ford, which wants to be a mobility company, means getting into all sorts of things, from bike sharing programs to self-driving robo-taxis. Uncertainty, though, is always hard to plan for, says Stephanie Brinley, analyst at IHS Market.
You're seeing it in some of the financial results. You're seeing it in different cost-cutting programs at different automakers. Ford's not alone in trying to balance this at all.
Car companies worry that one day people may choose not to own a vehicle and just use an app like Uber or Lyft, which are worth tens of billions of dollars. Robo-taxis could hasten that shift even more. GM bought an autonomous startup, Cruise, for a reported $500 million. Tech companies with deep pockets like Google's parent, Alphabet, have their own self-driving ambitions. Sam Fiorani at Consultants Auto Forecast Solutions says Ford is investing too.
I would say they're doing a very good job of it. They're just not promoting it yet, but they are moving forward and looking forward to the next era in the automotive industry.
And all that's really clear about that next era is that it's going to need as much money as possible to compete in, even if that means cuts today. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Morgan Stanley is today's bearer of ill economic tidings. In a report out this morning, the bank's analyst said that if the trade war between the United States and China keeps up and the president's threatened tariff increases on more Chinese imports come to pass, a global recession is within the realm of possibility. So the question now, it seems, is whether President Trump's approach to trade negotiations is working as he intended. Clete Willems was, till not too long ago, a White House trade policy official. Mr. Willems, thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So for those who don't follow trade perhaps as closely as, well, as you and I do, give me the 30-second elevator pitch version of President Trump's trade agenda.
Sure. Well, what President Trump is trying to do is get his arms around a set of longstanding unfair trade practices that's been going around in the global community. I think the most prominent example of that is what's happening with China. Obviously, he's expressed concerns with, you know, the NAFTA agreement, mm-hmm. with elements of the World Trade Organization. And I think in general, with sort of a lack of equitable treatment when it comes to tariffs around the world.
Do you think, though, that the president's tariff policies are the way to get done what he wants? It seems that it's very spur of the moment, shall we say.
Now, well, I actually think since the president has been in office, what he has tried to do is to take tariff action in many cases as a means of leverage. You know, not all tariffs are created equal, mm-hmm. as they say. So, I mean, I could go through, you know, one by one and parse them. But I think with China, it's really a means to an end.
Fair enough. And look, it's only a half-hour program. I appreciate you, you know, being willing to go through the harmonized tariff schedule. But look, yeah. let me ask you a more fundamental question, and it's going to sound like I'm poking the president in the eye, and I'm really not. Do you think he understands the way tariff works? Because if you look at his public pronouncements, his tweets, virtually everything he says about tariffs would seem to indicate he just doesn't understand how they work. It's not that the Chinese are paying. It's not that there are billions coming into the United States from overseas. It's American consumers who are paying these tariffs. And the president discounts that at every turn.
I think the tariff question actually is somewhat of a complex one. Now, I will be the first to grant you that tariffs do have somewhat of a negative impact on the U.S. economy and on consumers. They can have an impact on businesses who need to get those products from abroad. I mean, I'm not a tariff guy. All of that said, you know, who pays the tariff in any particular instance is not as simple as, oh, it's all China or it's all the U.S. consumer. And what we've found as we've analyzed it is that it's really different in each instance.
Well, I'm sure I don't need to cite for you the academic research that shows in the Section 232 and 301 tariff cases that the president has imposed on the Chinese, it is literally American consumers who are paying, sometimes in excess of 100% of the tariffs. And more to the point, though, with all respect, you didn't answer the question. Does the president understand how tariffs work?
No, I think that he does. And again, I would paint the 301 and the 232 with a different brush. I think when the administration put in place the 301 tariffs, they were expressly designed to pick products that the U.S. could source from other places. And you actually do see some of that happening. On steel, I would grant you that's a different situation. And I think that the steel tariffs were more controversial within the administration itself for that reason.
I'm not sure exactly when you left the administration, Mr. Williams, but the last you heard from folks inside the White House, what is your sense of the president's sense of urgency on fixing and getting to a deal with the Chinese, and does it carry into the 2020 campaign cycle farther?
I left the White House about a month ago. April 19th was my last day. I went and actually got to see the president a couple weeks after that. I think that with respect to China, that the president is willing to keep at the current strategy as long as it takes to ensure that China starts playing by the rules. I think if you look what you're hearing from the Hill, you see Democrats and Republicans alike all saying, stay tough on China, make sure you get structural reforms in China. Where you're getting feedback are things on steel and aluminum and saying we need to work with the allies more.
So look, I hear you on what he is hearing from the Hill and from people inside the Beltway writ large. But every single farmer we talk to and virtually every single small business person, with truly just one or two exceptions in the last year and a half, has said these tariffs are killing us.
Right. No, there's no question that there is going to be some pressure from the business community. I've been surprised, actually, that the business community, for the most part, has stayed firm with the president and said, you need to be tough on China because they're hurting my business. A lot of the pain that the agricultural community has been feeling in the past has been on the retaliation. The administration is trying to deal with that. But if we can get the commitments from China and the market access from China, it's going to be a much better situation.
Cleet Willems, former Deputy Director for International Policy at the National Economic Council at the White House, on his way to a job in the private sector. Mr. Willems, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it, sir.
It's my pleasure.
On Wall Street this Monday, not great. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For the men of Morehouse College, an all-male, historically black school in Atlanta, there is going to be one marker of college graduation noticeably absent for the class of 2019. As you might have heard, at commencement yesterday, Robert Smith, the billionaire founder of the tech investment firm Vista Equity Partners, announced he is going to pay off all of the student loans for this year's graduates. It's a gift that could help them avoid an economic burden that can be especially heavy for African Americans. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Robert Smith's gift could end up being worth up to $40 million, a meaningful dent in a really big number. Americans overall are carrying about $1.6 trillion in student loan debt. And
when it comes to African American students, we know that they borrow more than any other group, and they borrow at higher rates.
Laurel Espinosa is vice president for research at the American Council on Education.
To put a number to it, about one-third of black bachelor's degree recipients accumulated $40,000 or more in debt, compared to 18% of students overall.
One reason, she says, Black students tend to have less family financial support to help cover college costs. David Shepard is with the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, which supports HBCUs.
So to be able to come out of school and choose whatever job that you want because you don't have that debt burden on your back is significant.
Because African Americans tend to earn less than their white counterparts, paying off their student debt often takes longer, according to Feniba Addo, an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her research shows
student debt was explaining approximately around 10% of the racial wealth differences between white and Black young adults.
Having that debt wiped away, she says, will literally change the lives of these Morehouse men forever. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
India is, and here are two superlatives, the fastest growing major economy in the world and the world's biggest democracy. Something like 900 million people are expected to have voted in the country's general election, results of which will be announced on Thursday. So we've gotten our BBC and Marketplace colleague Anu Anand on the phone from New Delhi, where she is in the middle of a reporting trip, to give us some of the economic context for that election. Anu, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much, Kai.
Give me, would you, and I get that this is a tough question to do in like 30 seconds or a minute, but give me the economic snapshot, would you, of India?
The snapshot is that 80% of the workforce is made up of informal workers. They don't have contracts. They don't have wage protections. They don't have rights. They toil away for pennies a day, whether it's ironing clothes on the street, selling stuff at traffic lights, or even sitting in an elevator pushing buttons for minimum wage. And we recently had leaked information from the government that unemployment is at a 45-year high. So this is a really, really tough job market.
And it's an economy with plus or minus 1.3 billion people in it. And as you said, 80% of them are in essence in the gig economy, right?
Yeah, not just the gig economy, Kai. I mean, not just like doing things like delivering food or maybe doing, on-spec driving. I mean, we're talking about people. I met a guy the other day who only sells rubber bands. I mean, he just sells rubber bands because there are so many people and so few jobs. You got to find something really niche. You got to work hard at it, and then you got to fight your turf like anything. And that really comes across. You see it everywhere you go. And what's really struck me this time is it sort of feels like it's worse than it has been before.
Can I ask you about the education infrastructure over there? Because much has been made of that as a sort of growth area for this part of the Indian economy, right? Getting educated people into these jobs. Is that not happening?
So I think in America, you know, you tend to hear about the Sundar Pichais and the Satya Nadellas. And of course, there are a lot of Indians who are doing really, really well in super elite education. But what's happened is that as the population has grown, the numbers of schools and colleges has not. The private education industry has come in. A lot of people can't afford that. And so what's happening is that if you're at the lower end of the social scale, you're being squeezed. You're working harder to get higher and higher marks, 96% in college entrance exams, and you still may not get a seat.
So these election results are due out Thursday, I think. Crystal ball it for me, would you? What's going to happen? And then what's going to happen?
Right. So exit polls, notoriously difficult to trust these days, but most are saying that Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his party, the BJP, will come back to power. They will probably have a reduced presence in parliament, so there will be more of an opposition. One of the crazy things about this government has been, although they campaigned on economic platforms, they've also used a lot of religious ideology to undermine economic progress. So, for example, they closed tanneries because Hindus revere the cow is holy, and so they've lost thousands of jobs. So it's just going to be really interesting to see in the next term, will the BJP choose economic progress, or will it still try to galvanize its base with religious issues?
My Marketplace colleague, the BBC's Anu Anand, she hosts the first broadcast of the Marketplace Morning Report, which you can hear in our podcast feed if you miss it on the air. Doing some great reporting from India the past week, 10 days or so, and more to come. Anu, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Real pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
coming up.
It's not hard to realize that we have to have this as part of our energy portfolio.
The argument for nuclear power as green power. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 84 points on this Monday, 0.3%, closed at 25,679. The NASDAQ down 113 points, almost 1.5%, 77.02. The S&P 500 down 19 points, about 2/3%, 28.40. Jack Stewart was telling us about Ford up at the top of the program. Ford shares down 0.1% today. Tesla drove down 2.6%. You might have heard that a big HBO show involving thrones and swords and all that other stuff came to an end last night. Regardless of who won the throne, HBO's owner AT&T climbed 1.2% today. Dish Network down nearly 6% after it bought part of privately held EchoStar. That's a broadcast satellite service business. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.41%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood. On the Marketplace Tech Podcast, we give you a daily smart take on the digital economy, from cybersecurity around local elections to how your television might give you personalized ads. We help you better understand the tech that impacts your life and your work. Join me every weekday for Marketplace Tech. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Everybody gets hit with scams, right? Buy this, send your money here, no way you can lose, those kinds of things. Some people are more vulnerable to fraud like that than others are, and research does show that some older people who seem otherwise cognitively okay might be easy targets for being taken advantage of financially by strangers or even by family. David Brancaccio, the host of the Marketplace Morning Report, has been working on a new series about why and how damaging that fraud can be. It's called Brains and Losses. Hey, David.
Hey there.
This is, older people in this economy have been vulnerable for a long time. You've been reporting on this series for a while now. What have you learned?
Well, the experts, doctors, lawyers, social workers, tell us they've long seen people who become what they call exploitable as they age. People who, here's the key thing, otherwise seem pretty okay or perfectly okay, you know, on the ball, may find it harder to detect sketchy people or sketchy financial offers. But what we have now, Kai, is neuroscientists using brain scanners, like fancy MRIs, have started tracking structural changes in the aging brain that seem to point to these vulnerabilities. And you couple that with many older people who may be, you know, socially isolated or who may be prescribed multiple medicines with complex interactions. And it adds up to what some doctors are calling, here's the phrase, age-associated financial vulnerability.
Give me a for instance. You got a favorite character that you've talked to?
Oh, so many. But yeah. I want to talk about Michael McCadden, a Korean War veteran who became an importer of Italian crystal in Florida. A court found his daughter stole more than $500,000 from him, bought a house with the proceeds, apparently. His lawyer in Gainesville, Shannon Miller, told me that at 86, Mr. McCadden was very cogent, taught dance classes. But, you know, he had this one thing, she says. He had trouble pushing back when people like his daughter shook him down for money.
He has absolutely no money until literally today. We were able to get him his money back by being able to sell the house that the daughter had bought with the proceeds of this theft. And now we have put it into something called a voluntary guardianship. The doctor says Mr. McCadden is capable of making decisions for himself, financial decisions, but he needs someone to watch over him.
So his daughter is forced to give back the money in March, but I'm sorry to say, just weeks later, the other day, Michael McCadden passed away.
First of all, wow, his daughter. How about that? Look, let me ask you, though, the broader question, David. It's not all elderly who are vulnerable like this, right?
Absolutely. It is not all. It is some. In fact, life experience helps counteract some of these brain changes and other vulnerabilities. You know, the wisdom of age we talk about. But what neuroscientists and psychologists are working on are maybe someday tools to detect the vulnerability before people lose to the scam.
Give me a sense of scale, would you? I mean, we all get, you know, scamming phone calls and solicitations and all that. In the elderly, give me a sense of proportion.
Well, we looked at the survey data. A financial services firm estimates that people 50 and older lose $36 billion a year to fraud. Yeah.
Let's do a little service journalism here, David. What do you do, right, if you know somebody or are related to somebody in this vulnerable population? What do you do?
Well, I'm told among the things that work, outlining for people how these scams work, what they look like. But we're also supposed to have what we're calling in the series the talk with older loved ones. You're fine now, mom or dad, you're just fine, but maybe someday you'll need help with day-to-day financial decisions. Who do you want doing that with you? Under what circumstances? The talk.
David Brancaccio, the host of the Marketplace Morning Report, with his new series called Brains and Losses, the bottom line on aging and financial vulnerability. It is all this week on the morning show. Also at the newly redesigned marketplace.org, resources to help protect yourself and your loved ones from fraudsters. And please do listen for a one-hour Marketplace special on a lot of public radio stations around this country. David, thanks a lot. I look forward to hearing you.
Thank you so much.
You might have missed this a couple of weeks ago, but the company that owns the Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Plant in Pennsylvania has decided to shut it down this coming fall. First of all, yes, that Three Mile Island, the site of America's worst commercial nuclear accident back in 1979. Second of all, yes, one of its reactors was shut down after that, but the other one has been up and running ever since. Exelon, the company that owns Three Mile Island, says it needs public subsidies to keep the plant running, subsidies the state legislature has declined to offer. So the nuclear industry is making a new argument that keeping places like Three Mile Island open is the right thing to do for the environment. Miles Bryan reports.
I'm standing in the parking lot of Sunset Golf Course in Middletown, Pennsylvania. It's at the top of a hill and has a great view of Three Mile Island. The plant is set to shut down in September, but right now it's still operating. Huge gray stacks belch what looks like smoke into the sky.
You know, those stacks, yeah, they're large and they can tend to be menacing, but what comes out of them is actually water vapor and steam.
That's Steve Letavic. He's the manager of Londonderry Township, where Three Mile Island is located. His office is a couple of minutes from the golf course.
I see a great asset, a jewel of our community, part of the fabric of our community.
Letavic is a Three Mile Island booster because of its economic footprint. He says the plant supports about 675 well-paying jobs and brings in about $1 million in real estate tax revenue. But he says it's also good for the environment.
Look, I'm as green as you'll get. I'm an outdoorsman. And when you look at what climate change is doing to our environment, it's not hard to realize that we have to have this as part of our energy portfolio.
That might be confusing if you know the nuclear plant for what it's most famous for, the accident that caused one of the reactors to partially melt down and the fears that sparked of radioactive damage. Here's CBS's Walter Cronkite on that day in 1979.
It was the first step in a nuclear nightmare. As far as we know, at this hour, no worse than that. But a government official said that a breakdown in an atomic power plant in Pennsylvania today...
Most studies on the effects of radioactivity released during the accident have not found conclusive evidence it resulted in long-term health problems. But scientists have cautioned they can't rule it out. Today, nuclear power's advocates argue it's an important tool in the fight against climate change. A report by a bipartisan state legislative caucus found that Pennsylvania's nuclear plants prevent almost 40 million metric tons of carbon emissions every year. Ahmed Abdullah studies how we'll transition to a low-carbon energy system, what he calls deep decarbonization. He's at UC San Diego's Center for Energy Research.
All the existing evidence suggests that the existing renewable technologies are not sufficient to make up for nuclear's loss. If you're talking about the sort of deep decarbonization we need...
That kind of argument has helped nuclear power companies get public subsidies in states like Illinois, New York, and New Jersey. The subsidies come at a time when nuclear energy has been struggling to compete in the market against cheap natural gas. But some environmental groups that oppose nuclear power say the subsidies are a waste of taxpayer money.
There's a lot of different ways to poison the environment than by burning fossil fuels.
Timothy Judson is the executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. He says nuclear energy may not emit carbon, but it creates nuclear waste, a byproduct that can be radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years.
You know, it's deceptive marketing, right? And deceptive lobbying.
In Pennsylvania, nuclear energy advocates are still making their case. They're urging the legislature to pass public subsidies for the state's four remaining nuclear power plants. I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Game of Thrones recap edition. Also, spoilers ahead, so I'll give you a couple of seconds to turn me down. Here you go. 1001, 1002, 2003. That should do it. Okay, item one, clearly I was wrong about Sansa, although I do think she would have been better than Bran. Item two, first came Daenerys' coffee cup, then the plastic water bottle behind Samwell Tarly's leg last night. Check it out. Look it up. It's there. Everybody makes mistakes, I suppose. Most of all, though, for all the complaining, boy, oh boy, did we tune in. 19.3 million people watched the series finale last night, a record not just for Game of Thrones, but for any HBO show ever. Also, I kind of didn't mind it. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's down 84 today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 113. That's almost 1.5%. The S&P 500 down 19 points, about 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.